Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is my old friend, Mike Maripol. Maripol is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Western New England University, co-author of The Principles of Macroeconomics, Activists versus Austerity Policies. He's also a longtime WAMC commentator. But that's not the reason for our conversation today. The topic that brings Mike back to our studios is his late parents, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. Here in the waning days of the Obama administration, Mike Maripol and his brother are working to exonerate their mother. So, welcome, Mike. The first question is, what, you don't think that Trump will pardon your parents?
It's very important to make it clear that we're not asking for a pardon, because a pardon, like when Richard Nixon accepted the pardon, that means I'm guilty and I'm sorry for what I did.
Interesting.
And also, I don't think the federal government is in the business of pardoning people posthumously. It's possible. We are asking for actually a proclamation, and we are asking specifically for our mother because the evidence has mounted up over the years, with the coup de grace being the release of the grand jury testimony of my mother's chief accuser, her brother, David Greenglass. It turns out that the only thing they had on our mother at the trial was that she had typed up spy notes. At the grand jury, under oath, David Greenglass denied our mother was ever involved in anything. Neither he nor his wife Ruth at the grand jury made any mention of typing. It appears that the government arrested her just to put pressure on our father to talk. And when it looked like that wouldn't work, they manufactured evidence in February of 1951, 5 months after the grand jury, about the typing. And that's what convicted her, and that's what the judge used to sentence her to death.
Now, how do we know that she didn't type the notes?
Well, we know that there was no story about her typing until the last minute. We know that the government had no evidence against her. In the day my father was arrested, the attorney general, assistant attorney general in the criminal division, actually said there isn't even enough evidence to indict her. And then they went ahead.
Where
and
did he say that? Where is that?
In June 17th, 1950. It's
yes.
In an FBI document. So there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. And then they arrest her anyway because they want to use her as a lever. But in very interestingly, in February of 1951, this is like a month before the trial, there's a secret hearing before Congress where members of the prosecution team and members of the Atomic Energy Commission get together and they want Congress's okay to release classified information at the trial about the atomic bomb so they can get a death sentence against my father. And here's a very telling statement by a man who ended up being one of the assistant prosecutors, a guy named Miles J. Lane. He said, "The evidence against Mrs. Rosenberg is not too strong." Of course it wasn't too strong. They hadn't invented the typing story yet. "Is not too strong, but it's essential that she be convicted and given a stiff sentence." And then, weeks later, suddenly, out of the blue, one of the prosecution witnesses, Ruth Greenglass, the wife of David Greenglass, suddenly, quote, remembers Ethel typing. David Greenglass then is met by Roy M. Cohn, assistant prosecutor, who says to him, "Are you going to call your wife a liar?" And David Greenglass says no. And so he changes his testimony. Now, why do we know that they're lying? Because on 60 Minutes in 2001, David Greenglass says, "I don't remember anything about typing. I lied because I wanted to protect my wife. I don't even know if any typing occurred." That's in 2001. So we got the grand jury testimony. We got his admission in 2001. We've got a whole host of other pieces of information, which suggests to me that they made up the typing story at the last minute.
Okay, you were a little kid at the time.
Yeah.
You don't really even remember your parents, do you?
I remember pretty well. In fact, I do remember that my mother was a typist. Why? Because when I would write letters to my uncles and stuff, she would sometimes type them for me.
Wow. But the bad guy, according to this narrative, is your uncle.
Well, also the federal government, remember.
Yeah. No, I get the federal government part, but your uncle is the guy who you guys have long claimed was the real stinker here.
Yeah, well, there's a number of things. First of all, initially, and you and I know this, Alan, that up until the year 2008, we thought that we were even skeptical about whether David Greenglass was a spy. We thought he had been scared and confessed and then pointed the finger at my parents. Since 2008, we now know, yes, David Greenglass was a spy. Yes, our father was involved. But what we also have learned, which is kind of interesting, is that at a crucial moment when supposedly a sketch was drawn that purported to show certain secret principles about an implosion-type atomic bomb, when that sketch was drawn and then passed on to the Soviets, my father was out of the loop because the government had found out he was a communist. He had been fired from his job with the United States Army Signal Corps, and the Soviets said, they might be on to you. And they, in fact, gave him a pink slip. And he was out of the loop from January 1945 to sometime in 1946. And in the fall of 45 is the alleged time when the secret of the atom bomb drawing was made. Now, what's significant about this, in our opinion, is that it's David and Ruth Greenglass who are doing it on their own, directly with a Soviet, and my father's out of the loop. Yet it's that case, that story, the story about the secret of the atom bomb in a little sketch, which, by the way, it ain't the secret of the atom bomb, but we can talk about that. In a little sketch, my father's not involved. So, yes, we think David Greenglass did a number on both my parents, but on my mother's case, it was really horrible because basically he conspired with the government to hold her as a hostage when all she did was refuse to roll on her husband.
Have you ever personally had any doubt about their guilt or innocence?
I did. In fact, when I was a kid, I visited them in prison, and I was probably 9, and I said, look, are you really innocent? And of course they said, but of course we are. Well, you know, parsing that, what are they innocent of? They're innocent of the charge of stealing the secret of the atom bomb, but Julius isn't innocent of conspiracy to commit espionage. We know that now.
And how do we know that?
Well, Morton Sobel, the co-defendant in 2008, told a New York Times reporter, and that fits with a number of other things, things from, you know, decrypted Soviet messages, things like that.
And when the KGB files were sort of released, what did we find out there?
Well, we find out that sometime in 1942, my father gets involved with the local Soviet agent and starts to recruit people, people he went to college with, and deliver information. We're not exactly sure what kind of information. There's this back and forth about what exactly was delivered, but it's military industrial stuff. And it goes on with a brief interruption in 1945 to 46, and then there's some evidence, unclear evidence, but some evidence that it goes on into the late 1940s.
Why did the Russians give this information up after the Soviets disappeared?
Well, when the Soviet Union disappears, there are all these retired KGB agents who are out selling war stories, some of which we can believe, some of which we don't necessarily believe. And then there's the Russian Secret Service that made a deal. They made a book deal where for a rather significant sum of money, they let some guy in and look at stuff. And they selected an ex-KGB agent, a guy named Alexander Vasiliev. He goes in and he takes a lot of notes and he comes out. And then he and a guy named Alan Weinstein write a book called The Haunted Wood. And there's stuff in The Haunted Wood and there's stuff in Vasiliev's notes. Now, some of it may be a little bit, you know, uncertain because, you know, it goes through many different iterations and nobody's been able to check. I mean, you're a scholar. You know what it's like. You're supposed to be able to check scholarship. It's not, you don't accept it on faith. When somebody says, this guy said this on such and such a date, you then have a footnote and the footnote goes to an old newspaper and somebody should be able to go look at that old newspaper.
Now, Mike, you and your brother wrote a book a while back.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a question about you and your brother. Have you had differences with your own brother?
Oh, yeah, from time to time.
What do they revolve around?
Well, my brother even talked about this in his book, in his not his most recent book, but the one that we wrote together called We Are Your Sons. When he was an undergraduate and at University of Michigan, one could make the case that he was more of an activist than I was, that I was more the kind of person who would call a talk radio show or write a letter to the editor, and he was involved in more dramatic political stuff. But by the time we were in our 30s, certainly by the time we launched this campaign, we didn't have much differences.
So is Barack Obama likely to do this?
Only pressure will tell. People have to call him. There, you know, until the morning of January 20th, 2017, he can do this. He can issue a proclamation officially. He can make a speech. He can write a letter and sign it. He can do anything he wants.
So what's in it for him, Mike Maripol, to do that?
It's the right thing. And he's a constitutional law professor, and he's made statements about times in the past when we Americans have let our political passions ride roughshod over our principles. He made a major speech about the Japanese internment, and he was using it as a cautionary tale against, say, a Muslim registry or forbidding anybody to enter the United States because of their religion. Those were things he was worried about. Well, this is an example where the government used an individual as a hostage and, in a capital case, fabricated evidence. They had no sense that she was guilty of anything, but it was essential that she be convicted to put pressure on my father. When that didn't work, they killed the hostage. This is something that we should all be concerned about.
Well, let me talk to you. First of all, I'm very interested when you keep referring to your father, because, of course, you've always thought that your father, in addition to your Rosenberg father, you have Mr. Maripol.
Abel Maripol.
Who wrote Strange Fruit and therefore a bit of a cult hero himself. So I guess I'm interested in why your father wouldn't give in. I mean,
well,
he really did it.
We don't know. We absolutely don't know. But I'm going to make a guess. My guess is that it would have been impossible for him to say, hey, guys, you got this about one-third right. This is what I did, but all this atom bomb stuff, that's garbage. I will not plead guilty to that. I will be willing to plead guilty to this other stuff, but I ain't giving you any names. Now, put yourself in the position of the government when a guy says that to you. The government says, uh-uh, I'm not making that deal. You give names and you confess to what David Greenglass says you did, or...
But it was his wife and his kids, for God's sakes. Yeah.
So what does he do? He confesses falsely to stealing the secret of the atom bomb, goes away for 30 years, only because to save his wife. But then you see, Alan...
And his kids.
Yeah, but then he has to name all his friends. These are all the people he got involved. You know, there's a great line. In fact, it was the late Kurt Vonnegut. I met him at a party. And he said, there are two cardinal principles of ethics. Tell the truth, don't rat on your friends. And I think that was what it was. I think it was an issue of refusing to roll on the people that he himself had gotten in. Now, Alan, we are both speculating. To be honest with you, I have no idea if what I've just suggested is his reasoning. But as far as I can see, that's the best explanation I can give you.
It was a different time, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The Soviets had just basically done a great deal to win the war, but now they were our enemies.
Yes.
Do you have any insight you can offer us about your mother and father and what was so attractive about helping them?
Well, in the 1930s, there is a whole generation of people who are poor, who are living in cities, who are trying to scrape a living ahead, working in unions, etc. And who's their supporters? It's the communists who are organizing unions, not only communists, but certainly communists. It's the communists who are organizing rent strikes, who are putting furniture back in people's houses when they're being evicted. It's the communists, the communists who fight for black rights. I mean, who were the defenders of the Scottsboro rape accused in Mississippi, who, you know, escaped the death penalty basically because of national mobilization? In that context, the communists seem to have the right answers. And you join and you opt for a better world. You dream of a world without poverty, without exploitation, without racism. And what's the example? The journalist Lincoln Steffens comes back, and he's no communist. He comes back from Soviet Russia and he says, I've seen the future and it works. Who are you going to believe? A guy like Lincoln Steffens or the lying capitalist press, who you know lies because you catch them in lies every time there's some kind of confrontation? You know, you have a demonstration. The police come and beat everybody up. The newspapers say communist riots. So you're assuming that the things they say about the Soviet Union are lies also. Now, they were wrong, but they didn't know. And I know that this is true because my father, Abel Mirapol, felt that. And he and his wife had actually been to the Soviet Union in the 1930s when Stalin was ruling. They came back and they thought it was a fine place.
You grew up, of course, with A. Maripol, as you have just said. What was it like to be the son of the Rosenbergs, to know you were the son of the Rosenbergs, to have this fierce anti-communist hysteria, you know, in the United States? What was that like?
Well, I tell you, the worst thing about it was when I was much younger, when I had the name Rosenberg, a couple of times on the school bus, denying that I was related to those two spies. And that was awful. Now, I was 8 and 9 years old, and I certainly forgive that kid.
Did we get into a fight?
No, I didn't, because I would talk my way out of it. Mm-hmm. A couple of my friends got into fights, trying to defend me, telling others to leave me alone.
But the whole lefty community in New York sort of knew. I didn't know. So I put this thing on at Little Carnegie Hall.
The B-flat Stompers performed.
And you were in it, right? So Artie Traum says up there, he says, I learned this song from my friend Mike Maripol. And everybody in the place, it was a pretty lefty audience, goes, oh, I had no idea what they were doing. But apparently there were a good number of people who did know the secret, right?
Yeah, and it was interesting because every time I would decide I'm going to tell some friend, they'd always tell me they knew already.
You became a professor. You wrote a book, a wonderful book. You were lauded as an academic. Were you leading a separate life? The Rosenberg kid, Maripol life, and then the life of an academic who was not associated in that part of your life with the Rosenberg thing.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think I've always been all of me. You know, I've been my past, my present, my politics, my profession. It's all been integrated. Now, I don't wake up every morning and say, you know, the son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg is the right to write an economics blog, right? I don't do that. I never do that. But I certainly remember who I am and always have remembered who I am. And what's interesting is when my brother and I came out in public, every once in a while people would ask us questions, you know, how come you don't change your name? And we would always joke and we say, if we wanted to be anonymous, we could change our name. Just look at the New York City phone book. There's millions of Rosenbergs. There's a bunch of Michael Rosenbergs. There's even some Julius Rosenbergs. Ain't no Mirapols.
I went out with a girl named Rosenberg.
There you go. My brother did too.
So I get dirty letters all the time. I got a letter just the other day saying they should have cooked you. Hitler should have cooked you with the other Jews. I take it you haven't been exempt from getting mail.
Yeah, but not for a long, long time. Not for a long, long time.
We'll get some now after this.
When we first came out in public in the 1970s, we got some mail. But here's the difference, Alan. You get on the radio and you say things that make these people angry. I'm just a kid who loves his parents. Most right-wingers are not going to complain about a kid who loves his parents.
Oh, well, then you don't know the right-wingers I know. You don't know the guys who live in Adams Mass who write me letters and say, you know, you're a pinko, you're a commie, and then use other words that go along with it. But there's some very angry people out there.
No question.
Think we're at war with the communists,
except for the fact that now Russia's our big buddy.
I agree. I was just about to say that. I was just about to say that. So assuming for a second that the president now, Obama, leaves office and doesn't write the letter you want or the proclamation you want, then what do you do?
Well, and I don't want to preclude that because who knows but I would certainly try to approach him as a private citizen and say, okay, you're no longer the president. How about Barack Obama, the constitutional law expert, the man, the moral leader of the free world. How about you and your wife, who's a moral leader itself? We'd love to see you think about this, look it over, and tell us, just like Mike Dukakis. He's not governor of Massachusetts anymore, but he decided on his own to take the action of writing a letter to the president in support of this because back in 1977, Dukakis had done a simple similar thing. He had issued a proclamation exonerating Sacco and Vanzetti. And he urged President Obama to do the same thing as a private citizen. So if President Obama doesn't act as president, which we hope he will, and by the way, everybody listening to me, he will do it if you call the White House and then get 10, 100 of your friends to do the same thing. 45,000 Americans have already signed a petition to the White House to do this. And those include not only Mike Dukakis, but Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts.
Wonderful guy.
Michael Moore, Angela Davis, a whole host of other relatively prominent people, hopefully Alan Chartok.
I'm going to ask you very quickly, if I can, about Trump. Now we have a new guy, Trump, who is appointing, who is a friend, as you say, of Russia now. We're seeing that, and being Russians being accused of tampering in the election. But what do you make of this phenomena of Trump in the United States?
Well, I think what's fascinating is that we always need an enemy. And we've now got international Islamic terrorism as the enemy. So why not have Russia as an ally? And then on the sidelines, who knows, maybe China's the new enemy.
You're the economist, in many ways a political economist. I have a question for you. Why are our friends in Russia now, according to Trump, and not China?
China is, we have a very symbiotic relationship with China. They sell us a lot of stuff.
They own our paper.
And then they lend us money so we can continue doing it. It's unsustainable, but it works for a while. I mean, that's what bubbles do. You know, it works for a while. The stock market bubble goes up, 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 up until it stops. This relationship goes on and on and on until it stops.
Why is the stock market going up, 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 Mr. Economist?
I think that they believe that Trump's tax cuts and attempts to privatize Medicare, no matter what he said during the election, is going to be good for the 1% and the 0.1%, and they're driving it up. And it will be good for the 1% and the 0.1% until it stops. We will see how long the Trump bubble lasts.
It's always wonderful to talk to my friend, longtime friend, Michael Maripol, and he is the co-author of Macroeconomics, Activity versus Austerity Policies, also a longtime WAMC commentator, and I should add, the son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. Thanks so much, Mike.
My pleasure.